Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening. Hello. So good to see you all. My name is Misha Stone, and I'm a librarian in Reader Services. And welcome to the library. Thank you for joining us. It is a pleasure to welcome Jodi Picco back to the Seattle Public Library to read from her new book, The Storyteller. It is nice to have Jodi Picco back, and I know Seattle agrees. First, thank you to the University Bookstore for asking us to host this evening, to Simon & Schuster for our wonderful author, and the Seattle Times for their generous support. Also, I want to say a special thank you to the Seattle Public Library Foundation, whose support makes possible so many of our free library programs. Jodi Picco is a best-selling author of My Sister's Keeper, 19 Minutes, Sing You Home, House Rules and Lone Wolf, and many, many more. Jodi Picco is a best-selling author and the kind of writer who draws crowds because she connects to her readers in all of the best ways that literature can. She makes us think, she makes us think again, and she makes us feel. Picco has been asking challenging ethical and moral questions of readers for years now by telling compelling, well-researched stories with characters you come to know and care about. The Storyteller blew me away. I'm going to get teary here, actually. Writing a novel about the Holocaust with sensitivity and grace is no small accomplishment, and Jodi Picco has done it. And I don't know how many of you saw the article that just came out in the New York Times this week, that there we now know that there were more concentration camps in World War II and Nazi Germany than we ever thought, so it couldn't be more timely. The Storyteller tells many stories, all of them harrowing and beguiling, thought-provoking and eye-opening. And what makes it all the more eye-opening is what Picco also says here on a grand scale. Inside each of us is a monster. Inside each of us is a saint. Please welcome Jodi Picco.
Thank you so much for being here tonight. I love coming to Seattle. It is a pleasure to have a crowd like this.
I love you too.
Yeah, see, tomorrow night, Rebecca Miller's not going to get that, but Daniel Day-Lewis will, won't he? Yeah. I'm really excited to read to you from The Storyteller tonight. I am actually going to set up the book a little bit for you, because the reading I do is not from the beginning of the book. It's actually smack in the middle. Sage Singer is a 23-year-old baker who lives in a small New Hampshire town. And she's a bit of a recluse. She has a scar on her face. She doesn't like to be around people. She's attending a grief group because her mother recently passed away. And at this grief group, she meets this very unlikely friend, 95-year-old Joseph Weber. Everyone else knows Joseph. He is a favorite citizen who leads the 4th of July parade, who used to be a teacher at the high school, who coached Little League. Everybody knows and loves him. They become friends. And Joseph asks Sage for a favor. He would like her to help him die. Not because he's sick, but quite the contrary. He thinks the reason that he's lived this long is because it's God's little joke, since he used to be a Nazi, and he thinks he deserves to be punished. What he doesn't know is that Sage's grandmother is a Holocaust survivor. So if she helps him, is that mercy? Is it justice? Or is it revenge? That's kind of the framework of this novel. And the way that it's told in different points of view, the middle of it is an extended flashback told by Sage's grandmother, Minka, when Minka is a teenager in a Polish ghetto, and her subsequent experience during the war. So that's what I'm going to be reading to you from tonight. And here's all the information you need to know up front. Minka's a teenager. She fancies herself to be a writer. She has been working on this fantastical gothic fairy tale that she writes and that her best friend Daria reads as her editor. She is fluent in German because she studied it in school. And in the section that I'm going to be reading to you from, she has recently been taken from the ghetto with her father and brought to Auschwitz. In the section that I'm starting from, she has lost her father on the loading ramp, so she hasn't seen him in a few days. And her best friend Daria is in the barracks with her. Daria and I lived in a barracks with 400 other women. The smells were indescribable. Unwashed bodies, festering sores, rotting teeth, and always in the air around us, the sweet, charred, sickly scent of flesh burning. At night, the sleeping quarters were so tight, I could feel the hip bones of the woman behind me, twin daggers in the small of my back. When one of us rolled over in our sleep, the rest of us had to do the same. I had spent the week trying to get word of my father. Was he in a different part of the camp, working like I was? Was he wondering if I was alive too? I thought of him every morning as I was marched to work, past the shacks that were the men's barracks, and past the incessant operation of the crematoria. Daria and I were lucky because we had been assigned to Canada. It was an area where the belongings that had come in on the trains were sorted. The valuables were tallied and given to the guards, who brought them to the SS officer in charge of getting them to Berlin. The clothing went somewhere else. And then there were the items that no one needed: eyeglasses, prosthetic limbs, photographs. These were to be destroyed. The reason it was nicknamed Canada was because we imagined that country as the land of plenty. In Canada, if a guard was looking the other way, it was possible to steal an extra pair of gloves, underwear, a hat. The SS officer who was in charge of Canada spent a portion of the day weaving among us to make sure we did not steal. He was a slight man, not much taller than I was. I had seen him drag outside a prisoner who had hidden a gold candlestick up the sleeve of her jacket. Although we didn't see the beating, we could hear it. The prisoner was left unconscious in front of the barracks. The officer returned to walk through the aisles where we worked, with a nauseated look on his face. It made him seem human. And if he was human, how could he do this to us? Secretly, when he passed by, I thought of him as Herr Dybbuk, a human man too weak to force out the evil that had taken up residence in him. There was always a little ripple of awareness when Herr Dybbuk arrived or departed, as if his presence was an electric shock. Even though I did not turn around to watch, I could hear him approaching with another SS officer. They were speaking, and I eavesdropped on their German conversation as I ripped open a ham. So then, the beer hall? At 8. You won't tell me you're too busy again. I'm beginning to think you're avoiding your own brother. Over my shoulder, I peeked. I'll be there, Herr Dybbuk vowed. He was talking to the SS officer who oversaw Appell, the man in charge of the women's camp, the one with a tremor in his hand. The one who was not inhabited by an evil spirit, he was just evil, period. He ran hot and cold when it came to overseeing Appell. Either he seemed bored and the count went quickly, or he was on a rampage and took his fury out on us. Just that morning, he had raised his pistol and shot a girl who was too weak to stand upright. When the girl beside her jumped in response, he shot her too. These officers were related? The guard who was watching me sift through the suitcases shouted at me to get to work. So I reached into the pile that never seemed to get any smaller and pulled out a leather valise. This one I recognized. Inside were the candlesticks that had come from my grandmother, wrapped carefully in my father's tallis. Beneath that were his socks, his undershorts, a sweater my mother had knit for him. He told me once he hated it, that the sleeves were too long and the wool too itchy, but she had gone to so much trouble. How could he not pretend that he loved it more than anything? I couldn't catch my breath. I had not believed my father was truly dead until I opened this suitcase. With shaking hands, I lifted the sweater. This sleeve was the one my mother had been working on when my sister fell down and hit her head on the corner of the piano bench and needed stitches. This hemline she had measured against my father's midsection, joking out loud that she had not meant to marry such a gorilla of a man. Wiping my eyes, I started to pull the hem of the sweater. I rolled the yarn up around my arm like a bandage, a tourniquet for a soul that was bleeding out. The guard closest to me approached, screaming, jerking his gun at my face. "Do it," I thought. I kept pulling on the yarn until it lay in a nest around me. Somewhere Daria was watching, too afraid for her own welfare to tell me to stop, but I couldn't. I was unraveling too. The commotion attracted some of the other guards. When one leaned down to grab the candlesticks, I snatched them in one hand and took the scissors I'd used to cut up fur coats, pressing the blade against my throat. The guard laughed. The SS officer in charge of Canada pushed through the crowd. "Wem gehört dieser Koffer?" "To whom does this suitcase belong?" "Meinem Vater," I murmured. He looked at me for a long moment, then turned to the other guards and shouted at them to stop staring. "Get back to work," he said, and a moment later, he was gone. I learned how to survive. The best position for a Pell when we lined up in rows of five was in the middle, out of reach of SS guns and whips, yet close enough to other prisoners who could hold you up if you fainted. When lining up for food, halfway through the queue was best. The front of the line got served first, but what they were served was the watery bit that floated on top. If you could hold out to the middle of the line, you were more likely to get something nutritious. The work I did was not hard, not compared to what some of the other women had to do. We got to step inside from the cold into the sorting sheds. We hauled suitcases and clothing, but not stone. The most difficult part of my job was knowing I was the last person who would touch the clothes this man had worn, who would see his face in photographs, who would read the love letters his wife had written. The photographs were the hardest for me. They were the only proof that this person had been alive, had been happy, and it was my job to obliterate that evidence. But one day, I didn't. I waited for the guard to walk away and opened one album. I saw a young woman who must have been the owner of this suitcase smiling up at a young man. I looked at their wedding picture. Then came photos of a baby, carefully captioned. Anya, 3 days. Anya sits up. Anya's first steps. First tooth lost. And then the picture stopped. That night, I went home with pictures of Anya. The next day, I was bold enough to take 8 photographs. Before I went to sleep, I would take out these photos, this growing deck of the dead, and whisper their names. Anya, Herschel, Gerda, Chaim, Elias, still wailing after his bris, Zanla on her wedding day. As long as I remembered them, they were still here. At night, Daria couldn't sleep. The pain was so bad. Minka, she whispered, shivering, if I die, you won't have a picture of me to save. I knew her tooth was infected. Her breath smelled as if she was rotting from the inside out, and her cheek was swollen to twice its size. I hugged her back to my front, giving her whatever body heat I still had. The next day, Daria woke with a red face, skin on fire. I managed to set her beside me at the sorting bench. By the end of the day, though, I hadn't found a single item that would work to ease her pain. And then, in one leather satchel, slipped into a torn silk lining, was a fountain pen. My hand closed around it with an ache. I could see myself curled in the window of my father's bakery, writing my book. The story flowed like blood from my hand. I didn't even know if there was ink inside. To test it, I pressed the nib against the numbers that had been burned into my left forearm. The ink became a Rorschach blot, covering up what they had done to me. I slipped the pen into my jacket. This was for Daria, not for me. That night, I enlisted the help of another girl to prop Daria up at the evening appel. She could barely stand by the time we were sent back to the block 2 hours later. Her forehead was so hot, it blistered against my hand. Daria, I said, you have to trust me. She shook her head, near delirium. Leave me alone. I will, after I knock out that stupid tooth. My comment cut through whatever haze she was in. Like hell you will. Shut up and open your mouth, I muttered. But when I went to grab her chin, she reared away. Is it going to hurt? She whimpered. Yes. If I had any gas, I'd give it to you. Daria started to laugh. Gas, she wheezed. You don't have any gas. I realized how silly this was, given the mass extermination going on yards away from our hut. Suddenly, I was laughing, too. It was inappropriate and awful, and we could not stop. When we finally could control ourselves, we had our emaciated arms around each other, the gangly limbs of 2 tangled praying mantises. If you can't anesthetize me, Daria said, then distract me, okay? I could sing, I suggested. You want to cause more pain? Tell me a story. I took the pen out of my pocket and tried to clean it as best I could. Then I looked at my best friend, my only friend. I couldn't tell her a memory from our childhood because that would be too upsetting. I couldn't spin a yarn about our future because we barely had one. There was really only one story I knew by heart, the one I'd been writing for years. My father trusted me with the details of his death, I began. Anya, he would say, no whiskey at my funeral. I want the finest blackberry wine. No weeping, mind you, just dancing. And when they lower me into the ground, I want a fanfare of trumpets and white butterflies. A character, that was my father. He was the village baker, and every day, in addition to the loaves he would make for the town, he would create a single roll for me that was as unique as it was delicious. A twist like a princess's crown, dough mixed with sweet cinnamon and the richest chocolate. The secret ingredient, he said, was his love for me, and this made it taste better than anything I had ever eaten. I opened Daria's mouth gently and positioned the pen at the root of her swollen gum. I lifted a stone I had pried from the latrines. Daria was finally relaxed, caught in the gauze of my words. In fact, the whole hut had gone quiet. All of the women were listening to me. So I told them of the people of the village who were on edge. There seemed to be a monster in their midst. My father trusted me with the details of his death, I said. But in the end, I was too late. Swiftly, I smashed the stone into the pen. The sound that Daria made was unearthly. Her eyes were bright red, the blood vessels having burst. I'm sorry, I cried. Minka, she said, through the blood, through her tears. She grabbed my hand, and I realized she was trying to give me something. In her palm was a broken, rotted tooth. It was Daria who told me to write it down. You never know, maybe one day you'll be famous. I laughed at that. More likely, the story will die with me. But stories outlive their writers all the time. I think in the end, that's why I did it. There would be no photograph of me for someone to steal or memorize. There was no family at home anymore to think of me. If I had to die in this hellhole, maybe someone would survive and tell their children the story a girl had told at night in the block. Fiction's like that once it's released into the world. Contagious, infectious, spreading from the person who created it to the person who listens and passes it on. Ironically, it was the photographs that made it possible. One day I dropped the deck of faces on the floor. Hurrying to gather them again, I realized some were face down. On the white cardboard of one photo, I read, Moshe, 10 months. Well, someone had written that. It was a small square, smaller than what I was used to, but it was paper, and I had dozens of them and a fountain pen. I wrote until the fountain pen bled itself dry, until as much of my story as possible was scratched in tiny, careful German prose on the backs of over 100 faces of the dead. Raus! One minute I was asleep, dreaming that I had been brought to a room with a table a kilometer long on which there were heaps of food, and I had to eat my way from one end to the other before I'd be allowed to leave. The next, several guards filled the block, looking for contraband. Sometimes we knew about an inspection. Today, though, there had been no warning. In my bunk, buried under the straw, was the deck of photos with my story written out. A girl who had hidden a radio was dragged outside. My heart started up like a machine gun. I saw the Blukaltesta's hand close around the photographs, which I had secured with a thread pulled from the hem of my uniform. Daria stepped forward. They belong to me. My jaw dropped. She's lying. She doesn't speak German. I was hauled out of the block. It was pouring outside, and the wind raged like a dragon. Standing in the center of the courtyard, rain pelting his wool uniform, was the SS officer I called Herr Tremor. There was no shudder in his grasp as he lifted a whip and brought it down on the back of the girl who had hidden the radio. She lay face down in a puddle. After each blow, he yelled at her to get up, and each time she did, he struck her again. I would be next. As we approached Herr Tremor, he looked up, the rain sleeting across his features. His eyes were like glass. I am not done here. Should we wait, Schutzhaftlagerführer? Asked the guard. I have no intention of standing around all day in this pissing rain because some animals cannot follow rules, he said. I lifted my chin. Very precisely in German, I said, Ich bin kein Tier. I am not an animal. His gaze narrowed on mine. He lifted his right hand, the one holding the whip, and cracked it across my cheekbone. Dat yirst du dich. You are mistaken. I fell to my knees in the mud, holding one hand up to my cheek. The tail of the whip had cut a gash under my eye. The girl on the ground beside me caught my gaze. Her flesh was peeled back like the petals of a rose. Behind me, I could hear conversation. The guards were telling someone else what my infraction was. This new officer stepped over me. Schutzhaftlagerführer, a voice said. You're busy here. With your permission, perhaps I can help. I could see only the back of his uniform and his gloved hands. His boots were so shiny that I stared, wondering how he could walk through so much mud without getting them filthy. Herr Tremor shrugged and turned back to the girl on the ground beside me. The other officer walked off. I was hauled upright and taken across the compound to an office. There was a large wooden desk and many filing cabinets and an ornate chair. In that chair was the officer in charge of Canada. And spread out in front of him were all of my photographs, flipped onto their bellies to reveal my story. Leave us, he said to the guard. So, you speak German. My eyes flickered toward the photographs. I studied in school. You realize you stole material from the Reich? I'm sorry, it was a mistake. He raised his brows. It was a mistake to willfully steal something? No, it was a mistake to think the photographs didn't matter to the Reich. He opened his mouth and snapped it shut. He could not admit that the photographs were valuable, because that was tantamount to admitting that those who were killed had worth. But he couldn't admit the photos were meaningless, because doing so would dilute his argument for punishing me. That's not the point, he said finally. The point is they do not belong to you. The officer picked up one of the pictures. This story, where's the rest of it? I imagine the guards ransacking the block, trying to find more photographs with writing. When they didn't, would they just start hurting people until someone gave them the answer they wanted? I haven't written it yet, I confessed. This surprised him. I realized he assumed I was simply recounting a tale I'd read elsewhere. I wasn't supposed to be intelligent enough to create something like this. You, he said. You made this up. We were speaking in German. We were having a conversation about writing, as if at any moment he might not take out his pistol and shoot me in the head. Most girls write of love. You chose to write about a beast, he said thoughtfully. The Dnestra. You've heard of it? Was this a test? A trick? The ancient Greeks, which is what I studied in school, wrote of the Dnestra. It had the head of a lion and the body of a man. It could speak all the languages of the human race, which, as you might imagine, the officer said dryly, came in handy. But the Dnestra had one peculiar trait. It would save the severed head of its victim, sit beside it, and weep. He fixed his gaze on me. Why do you think that was? I swallowed. Perhaps some monsters still have a conscience. The officer's nostrils flared. He came around the desk and I immediately cowered, throwing up my arm to block the blow. You realize I could make an example of you, publicly flog you like the prisoner the Schutzhaft Lagerführer was punishing earlier, or kill you. Tears sprang to my eyes. As it turned out, I was not too proud to plead for my meager life. Please don't. I'll do anything. The officer hesitated. Then tell me, he said. What happens next? Thank you. So before I let you guys ask me some questions, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the origins of this book and some of the research behind it. This book actually began with a different book, Simon Wiesenthal's The Sunflower. In that book, Wiesenthal recounts his time as a concentration camp prisoner when he was called to the bedside of a dying Nazi soldier who wanted to confess to a Jew, any Jew would do, what he had done in the hopes that that Jew would then absolve him of his sin and he could die in peace. In the course of this book, Wiesenthal comes to see that he actually can't forgive this man, even if he had wanted to, because he is not the victim upon whom that sin was perpetrated. Those victims are dead, so basically this Nazi soldier is out of luck. And in the years since this book has been published, it's been republished, and every time there are new epilogues in the back that have been written by politicians and theologians and philosophers, all of them weighing in on Wiesenthal's decision and then talking about their own traditions and what those traditions would have urged them to do in that situation. And it got me thinking, can you do something really bad in your life and spend the rest of your life making up for it by doing good deeds and ever erase that stain on your soul? By the same token, if you consider yourself a morally good person, is there any one thing that would make you cross that balance and maybe do something we would all consider slightly immoral? Like, for example, killing somebody. And could I take what Wiesenthal wrote all those years ago and update it for today's generation in a way that would make us understand why this topic is still important 70 years later? So when I started doing my research, I knew right away I was going to need to talk to some Holocaust survivors. I actually started with my mother. My mother is not a Holocaust survivor at all, but my mother should work for the U.S. government because I called her up and I said, okay, you live in Scottsdale, you've been to some ADL talks, can you find me some survivors? Literally, 30 minutes later, I had a list of 9 survivors and all their contact information, and they were all ready for me to call. So I'm going to tell you about 3 of them today. The first man I want to talk about is a man named Bernie. Bernie grew up in a small town in Poland that had 5,000 Jews in it. By the end of the war, there were only 36 left. His father was a dentist. He told me how when the Germans came in and began doing roundups, he and his family and friends used to go downstairs into the basement of their apartment and hear the Germans walking around upstairs trying to find people to take off to the concentration camps. One night, he was down there with a friend of the family who had a newborn, and the baby was crying. It wasn't a newborn, I guess it was a little baby. And they were feeding it little bits of bread, trying to get the baby to be quiet. Baby wouldn't shut up, so she kept juggling this baby on her shoulder, and she accidentally smothered her own child. She walked upstairs, sat on the curb, and just sat there for 3 days until the next roundup happened because she really did not want to be alive anymore. He was eventually taken from his home. When the Germans came to get him, he was grabbing onto the doorway of his house, and he grabbed the mezuzah that was tacked into the doorway. If you don't know what that is, it's a little strip of metal that has a blessed scroll inside it that's meant to protect a Jewish house. He pried this off the doorframe, and he held it through the entire war in these three fingers folded down. At the end of the war, he had to have his hand surgically straightened because his fingers had fused shut. And when I met with him, he showed me that mezuzah that he had carried all that time. He was taken to Ternopil in wagons. There were 10 wagons full of Jews, and the German soldiers stopped because they wanted to get a drink. And they told all the Jews to just sit and not move. Well, after several hours, his dad stood up because his dad had a bad back. And one of the villagers came into the pub to tell the soldiers that a Jew had stood up. And the soldier came outside and shot his father in the head in front of him. That would have been, of course, devastating, but Bernie was young, and what was even worse was that when you were shot in the head, you could see brains, and that scared him. So his mother made him the promise that when it was his turn to die, he would die with a bullet to the heart. And for those of you who are parents in the audience, just imagine having to make that kind of promise to your kid. The second survivor I want to talk about is relatively famous as survivors go. Her name is Gerda Weissman-Klein. She won the Presidential Medal of Freedom. She was awarded it by President Obama a few years ago. Gerda also lived in Poland in an integrated community with lots of non-Jewish friends. In 1942, her parents were taken to Auschwitz. She was taken to a series of work camps. And finally, in 1945, in January, as the Allies began to march on these camps, they were closed down. And she was sent with 4,000 other women on a 350-mile march in the dead of winter to Orenburg. Of those 4,000 women, less than 150 survived. The reason she survived, she said, is because she was wearing her ski boots, which, when she was taken from her home in June of 1942, her father said, "Wear the ski boots," and she had those on her feet. Her best friend Ilse died in her arms during that march, and at the end of the march, she was liberated by the Allies, by the American soldiers. She weighed 68 pounds, her hair was white, she had not bathed or showered in 3 years. And a young American soldier held a door open so that she could walk through first. She was very shocked, and she said, "I am a Jew, you know." And he said, "I am too." And they wound up getting married. Everybody likes that story. The last story I want to tell you about is Manya's. Manya is the survivor that I probably grew closest to when I was doing my research. I actually stayed at her house, and after I had done the research, she kept emailing me and saying things like, "Are you done yet? You know, I'm an old woman and I could die soon." Happy to say she's alive and well. She was born also in Poland and lived in a Christian neighborhood. And Manya was very, very bright. And she wanted to go to the state high school because it gave you the best education. But the state high school only accepted two Jews, and those two Jews were already there. So her dad's accountant, who was Christian, managed to get her into Catholic high school. And at Catholic high school, she did the same thing everyone else did, but during catechism, she sat outside and did her homework. At Catholic high school, you had to take a language, and she had a choice of either taking French, which was taught by a very large, unattractive nun, or taking German, which was taught by a very young, handsome teacher. She took German. She took a lot of German. In fact, she became his star pupil, and she became fluent in the language. And like Minka, that saved her life multiple times during the war. When she was put into the ghetto, she initially was working in a factory, which was sort of the German word for workshop, in a secretarial position for a man named Herr Baker. All the young girls working for him liked Herr Baker. He called them meine Kinder, my children. He was very kind. So it was really a shock when one day he got very mean, very angry, and started screaming at the girls and said, "Nobody leaves here today. You do not leave here. You stay through the night. You will not be going back home." She got very scared. She ran home. She was there a few minutes when a German soldier showed up and said, "Manya must come back to the factory." She found out later one of her best friends had pawned her watch to that soldier to bring Manya back. And when she got there, she found Herr Baker standing outside with a rifle. to keep the girls from going out, but more importantly, to keep the Nazis from coming in, because that was the night of the first roundup in that ghetto. And that was the last time that Manya ever saw her mother or her little brother. The next week, Herr Baker, trying to keep his girls safe, arranged for them to go live on a farm where they could work. He thought that would be better. At the farm, a few weeks later, a boy showed up, and he said to Manya, "I know what happened to your mother." And he told her about a place called Treblinka and these giant showers that weren't really showers. And Manya said she thought he was crazy. They all did. They thought he was, touched in the head and said, "Why would you even say that? That makes no sense." And they dismissed him. When the farm closed, she was sent to a work camp called Pianki. There again, she was in a secretarial office because she spoke such good German. And while she was there, she was reunited with her dad, who was a very broken, fragile man at this point. And he was being sentenced to hard labor. So one day she took an empty file folder, closed it up, and marched all the way to the commandant's office, saying, "I am under strict orders to only show the contents to the commandant. I can't show it to anyone else," speaking in German the whole way. She got into the commandant's office. He opened the folder, looked at it, stared at her. This was not a nice guy. He had hanged someone the week before for trying to escape. And she said to him, "I don't know if you have a daughter, but if you do, I hope he would do for you what I need to do for my father." And she told him how hard labor was killing her father. And he listened to her and scribbled something down and changed her father's position so that actually he did wind up surviving that camp. When Pianki closed, they were both sent to Auschwitz. The last time that Manya saw her father was on the loading ramp at Auschwitz. Unlike Minka, she was not there for a long time. Most people who stayed at Auschwitz for a long time died. For most of the Jews, though, it was a transfer facility. And so Manya found herself stripped down and being brought to a very large shower. And all of a sudden, she remembered what that boy had said at the farm. She fully expected to die, but instead, she was deloused, her head was shaved, she was given a tattoo and striped clothing, and a few days later, she was taken to Hindenburg, where she was working, doing night welding. One of the German soldiers heard her speaking German, and he said, "Have you ever done inventory?" And she said, "Oh, yes, I did inventory all the time. I know how to do inventory." She had never done inventory. So they moved her again into the secretarial office where she learned how to do inventory. And every time that there was an inspection from higher up, they locked her in the closet because had she been seen in her striped uniform working with Germans, she would have been shot on the spot. After 4 years of work camps, in 1944, she was sent to Bergen-Belsen. Nobody worked at Bergen-Belsen. You went there to starve and to die. She was living in a barracks with 900 other people. She cut her arm and it became infected. She contracted typhoid. Running a fever, very ill, one day she managed at dawn to crawl over all these bodies to get to the doorway, rolled onto her back, and noticed there was no one in the guard booth. There was a white flag, and the Allies, the British, had come to liberate Bergen-Belsen. She was sent to a medical tent because her arm was infected, and the doctor looked at it and said, "We have to amputate." And she said, "Please do not take my arm." And they wound up giving her the last shot of penicillin they had, which they had been saving for an Allied soldier. And to this day, she still does have her arm. The last person I want to talk to you about is not a survivor. He is a warrior. His name is Eli Rosenbaum, and he is the director of the Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section of the Department of Justice. We in the United States have 35 people who every day go out trying to find Nazi war criminals, even now, even when they're in their 90s, in addition to other perpetrators of genocide. Since 1989 alone, 165 people have been turned away from entering the U.S. because of this department. In 1981, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that if you were a guard at a concentration camp, whether you were a cook or whether you were the guy putting the tablets into the showers for the gas, you were still responsible for crimes against humanity. And that's because they see those concentration camps as cogs in a wheel. Had anyone stopped doing their job, the entire thing would have broken down. What's interesting about this is that prior to 2007, our genocide statutes in the U.S. were pretty archaic. We could only prosecute crimes that were committed by Americans against Americans. So that's pretty much Custer's last stand, and that's it. After 2007, now, if someone commits genocide and an American is killed, we can prosecute. Or if someone commits genocide and hides in America, we can prosecute. But all these Nazi war criminals, we have no jurisdiction over. All we can do is find them, get them denaturalized, stripped of their citizenship, booted out of the country, and hope that their origin country will try them. He has had, Eli has had some pretty remarkable cases. Arthur Rudolph was a real-life rocket scientist. He created the Pershing missile, the Saturn V rocket. He also was a Nazi. Eli got him stripped of his citizenship, sent back to Germany, and tried. A guy named Alexander Lalakis was the director of the Lithuanian Security Police. On his order, 55,000 out of 60,000 Jews in the Vilnius area were marched out to ravines, dug on the edge of town, shot, and left to die. Eli found out this guy was living in Massachusetts since the 1950s. So he went to his house with one of those orders, and the guy laughed at him and said, "Show me something I signed," because his name was just typed at the bottom. Well, for 10 years, that case lay dormant because we did not have access to Nazi files. With the fall of the Cold War, we suddenly did, and there were dozens of documents with Alexander Lalakis' name signed on it. He was denaturalized, sent back to his country of origin, but never tried because of declining health. And lest you think this is not important nowadays, I'm going to tell you about the man who in the 1990s was brought to a U.S. attorney's office by Eli's group because they found out that, yes, he too had been a Nazi guard. And after that interview, the press somehow got wind of it, which is not kosher. But the press found out, and they surrounded his house. And he came out of the house with a gun, and he started shooting. Now, he was 85 years old. It was upstate New York. He was not a good shot. But the police had to come, and they had to disarm him. So they shot him in the leg. And as he lay on his porch, bleeding, absolutely confused, in broken English, his last words were, "Why you shoot at me? I not Jew." That was in the 90s. This is why it's still critically important to talk about the Holocaust, even though it happened 70 years ago. First off, it's not a Jewish problem. 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. Guess what? 5 million non-Jews died in the Holocaust. It is a human rights problem. Second of all, there is no statute of limitations on murder. Third of all, it is completely hypocritical for us to live in a country where we allow former war criminals to make their home here, knowing they may even run into their victims at the grocery store, who also make their home here. And yet, on a daily basis, we deport immigrants whose only crime is having the wrong paperwork or no paperwork. And finally, the reason this is still really important is because genocides are still happening every day. And if the United States can get a reputation of being the policeman for this, it can save lives. Maybe right now there's some guy in Uganda who's got a gun up to someone else's head, and he's thinking, you know what? They were looking for Demjanjuk until he was 91. I don't want to be hiding until I'm 91. And so instead he puts that gun down and he runs away. That's how you start changing the world. So for all of those reasons, it's really important to keep on telling these stories. That's my little spiel about the storyteller. Thank you. So now I am happy to take your questions. They can be about anything at all. The only thing I would ask is please don't give away the ending of a book or I'm going to hurt you. Anyone got a question? Yep. Oh, my God. Okay. What's next? That's like giving birth and showing someone your newborn and them going, "Are you pregnant yet?" The next book is currently called The Elephant Graveyard. I may change that, but that's what it is right now. It's a story of a woman named Alice Metcalf, who is an elephant researcher who studies elephant cognition and grief. You may not know this, but elephants have very elaborate grief rituals, just like humans do. So, for example, elephants can look at skulls, different elephant skulls, and know if that is an elephant they knew or they didn't know. You can see an elephant calf come up and put its trunk into the mouth cavity of a skull that was its mother's, because that's how he would have greeted her. Elephants have been known to break into places where they're doing research with bones and take those bones back to the place where an elephant died. And it's very common for them to go back to those spots where an elephant passed away and to just stay there for a little while and pay their respects. And their behavior gets very different in those areas. And they do that for years and years and years. All those things are very fascinating. And that's what Alice is studying at her husband's elephant sanctuary. Until one night when there is a horrible accident and one of the elephants tramples a caretaker. And that same night, Alice Metcalf vanishes from the face of the earth. The only witness to this is her 3-year-old daughter, Jenna, who remembers nothing. The book opens 10 years later when Jenna is 13. Jenna has never believed that her mother would leave her willingly, and she decides to get this case opened as a missing persons case by partnering up with a publicly disgraced psychic who is going to help her find more information and then getting the original detective to open up the case, knowing very well that what she finds out just may be something she does not want to hear. So that's the framework of the book. The best part of it is that it has the best ending I have ever written in my life. I'm not telling you what it is, though. Anyone else? Yeah. Oh, sure. Of all the books that I've written, all the research I've done, what was my most favorite research? Hands down, it was ghost hunting. And I've talked about this before, probably in Seattle too, but it was for Second Glance. I almost made that all up, but then I realized all of you would tell me I'd gotten it wrong. So I wound up going to the closest paranormal society where I live, which is the Atlantic Paranormal Society in Rhode Island. And how many of you guys watch the show Ghost Hunters? Do you know that show? Okay, I knew them when they were just Roto-Rooter plumbers. They were not TV stars yet. So they ran this group, the Atlantic Paranormal Society, and I wrote them asking if they could help me, and they said, come on down, we'll teach you about ghosts. So apparently dying is like getting on a bus. You're supposed to go to whatever comes next and get off at the end of the line, but sometimes people get off to use the rest stop, and when they come back, the bus is gone. That's a ghost. If you ever see a ghost, you're supposed to say, go to the light. And they'll disappear. So I'm not buying this. So they take me to an abandoned mental institution in Providence where people were dying in their care, so it closed in the 1970s. So there's no electricity there anymore. All the buildings are boarded up. Some of the buildings have, you know, been victimized by fire. And basically they tell me to park facing backwards because when you're ghost hunting, you are also usually trespassing. And we do that. And we go up to one of these rooms that has, like, boarded, you know, boards on the windows. And when you peek inside, it's an old exercise room with a pool in it. And there are what look like balls of light in the distance. Those balls of light, they take a picture of, and they turn into big globules in the viewfinder of the digital camera. That's what they say is energy-changing form or a ghost trying to happen. Again, I'm not really buying this. So then we walk through an area where a building's burned down with people in it. And as I'm walking, all the hair stands up on the back of my neck. And before I can say anything, this guy takes his camera and goes, takes a picture back there. There was nothing behind us. When we turned around, it was pitch black, like that. But in the viewfinder of the digital camera was this white, misty, wraith-like thing. And I was like, okay, maybe you guys have a point. So then they took me over the border to a home that had called them because they felt they had paranormal activity going on. We went up to the attic where they had been hearing moans and groans and bumps and thumps. It had a little rounded door with a padlock. They gave me the key to the padlock. We went upstairs. They set up a video camera. You see this on their show. You see it in my book. This is what ghost hunters do. They take tons of video footage, and then they go through it to see if there's something paranormal. So I'm the last one out of the attic. They go downstairs to talk to the owners of the house. I close the door, lock it up. I stop off on the second level of the house because there's babies there, 6-month-old and a 22-month-old who are both fast asleep in cribs in spotless rooms. They're totally fine. And then I go downstairs, and I'm listening to the owners say how they've come home to find all the cereal spilled out in the center of the kitchen floor in a big pile. They've come home to find all the faucets running. One night they heard calliope music at about 2 in the morning, traced it to the stairs of the attic, and found a toy piano playing without batteries. When I heard that, I said, I'm going to go check on your kids. So I went upstairs, and in the first kid's room, the 6-month-old, there was, you know, where there had been nothing on the floor before, there were 6 pennies lining the edge, like a little crime scene outline of the crib. And when I picked them up, they were all dated between 1968 and 1973. Put them in my pocket, went to the next kid's room, same thing as if, you know, they had just been put there because I was the last one in the room. There were 6 pennies lining the crib, all dated between 68 and 73. Then I took the key out of my pocket, opened the padlock, went up to the attic, turned on the lights, and under the video camera tripod, as if someone had gone, were another 15 pennies, all dated between 1968 and 1973. If you look in your purse or your pocket, you're going to have a hard time finding a single penny with that date on it because most of them are out of circulation. I didn't know what was going on. I just thought, this is really weird. I wasn't scared, but it was definitely not what I was expecting. And the guys wound up going back 2 more times, deciding there was paranormal activity there, doing some research. 2 people died in that house between 1968 and 1973. Pretty cool. Yeah. In the red, yeah. Are there any movies that I want to see made of my books? Well, I'd like to see them made well. Let's start with that. There are a couple of things in the works right now that would be fun to see. Sing You Home is still owned by Ellen DeGeneres. She is really lazy and slow. And all of you need to go home and email her or tweet her and say, what's going on, Ellen? Make the movie. But really, seriously, I don't know what she's doing. But she still does have the rights to it. And I still would love for her to be able to make that. Change of Heart has been spearheaded by an independent producer. And actually, it was a year ago. I remember being here. It was exactly a year ago when the man I had done research with, Robert Towery, was executed this day. I was in Seattle. So, very, very interesting story, actually. And that book has been taken under its wing by an independent producer who's been very careful with it. I co-wrote the screenplay with a very good screenwriter. It looks very much like the book, which is lovely. And she really wants to go the festival route, so I'm hoping that will happen. And the other news, which, again, doesn't mean anything until we find out a little more information, is that House Rules is being developed by CBS as a pilot for a TV drama series. You're all so enthusiastic. I love you. Should we take a couple more questions? One more? Two more. In the white. Yep. Most of the stories, the question is, where do the ideas really come from? Is it from things in my life, or is it from things that I go out and do research for? Luckily, I do not write about my life, for the most part. My characters have really crappy lives. I don't. I have a great life. So I'm very fortunate that I don't have to draw from my life for their experiences. There are only a couple of times that I have actually had a book intersect very tightly with my own life. My Sister's Keeper was one of them. I talk about this all the time. I have a middle son who had benign tumors in his ears that were growing towards his brain that could have killed him. He wound up having 13 surgeries in 3 years, was in and out of hospitals, has marginal hearing in his left ear, in his right ear, and is profoundly deaf in his left ear, and, had a great outcome. He is a very accomplished tenor singer who is really, let's all cry for him. He's in Jamaica with his a cappella group right now singing. So, that experience of being in the hospital and that experience of being a mother who didn't have time for all her kids really was something I wanted to write, and that became My Sister's Keeper. Sing You Home is the other book that was very personal for me. I was in the middle of writing a book and working up a story about gay rights and gay parenting, which is just something I personally believe in, when my oldest son, Kyle, came out to me in his college application essay. Not really a shock to me. I knew he was gay when he was like 5, but it was good that he knew. And and all of a sudden that book became a mission, a real mission for me, and it's been one of the highlights of my career to have toured the world and to have run into so many young people who've said, I wanted to kill myself, or I told my parents and they disowned me, and this book made me feel normal again. That's a really lovely thing. But most of the time, the ideas come from what-if questions, things that I don't know and that I go out and do research for. There was one question. Yes, you, because you're so excited. Yeah. I kind of love you. You're so cute. Yeah, that's a really good question. Have there been times that I've been doing research that I had a hard time? There's a difference between logistically hard, like finding a Yupik Eskimo who wants you to go to his house in Akiak, Alaska, right? Yeah. No, well, there have been two really difficult research experiences. One was for Sing You Home, when I had to talk to Focus on the Family. Not my favorite group. But, but I will say, to their credit, they were willing to talk to me. This woman who had a 6-hour interview on the phone with me, I literally had to keep putting the phone down and, like, going into another room and screaming because she was upsetting me personally as a mom of a gay son. But at least she was willing to tell me her side of the story. So I really do respect Focus on the Family for knowing that I was writing this book and at least being willing to tell me their point of view. Even if it's not what I personally agree with. But I do find it really weird that they were willing to even give me their point of view. I don't know why. But anyway, and it is, it's funny. I get a lot of hate mail for that book still. And I get a lot of conservative Christians saying, you're giving Christianity a bad name. And I say, no, actually, I'm not. I know lots of really amazing, accepting Christians. But Focus on the Family thinks it's speaking for you. And I don't believe that. So don't shoot the messenger. Go tell them. The other research that went awry was for Keeping Faith. So I had done this interview with an Episcopal priest who told me all about revival tents when he was a kid, and a Catholic priest who told me all about his life. And I really needed a rabbi, because I wanted to round it out for that book. So I had to find a rabbi. And so I went to Dartmouth, which is the town where I live, is where Dartmouth College is, and I asked if their local, their rabbi for the school would be willing to talk to me. So he said, come down to his office. And before I even said a word, he sat me down and he said, if you write this book, you're going to be perpetuating mistruths that have dogged Judaism for 5,000 years. And I was like, I haven't even told you what the book's about yet, you know? And he didn't want to talk to me. And I wound up leaving his office, finding out that he was being fired. 2 weeks later, he left. It had nothing to do with me. He was just in a mood. But I still needed to find a rabbi, right? So I networked, and I found this woman who had her own congregation in Philadelphia. She had been born into a Christian Catholic family, and she converted to Judaism, and she happened to be a lesbian. And I thought, well, she's got to be open-minded, right? And she was. She was absolutely amazing. And in fact, she was so enjoyable to work with during Keeping Faith that I went back to her for several books after that when I needed help as well. Thank you all for coming out here tonight.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.